Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for March the 4th, 2018, the first Sunday in a new month of March. Thanks for being with us for our weekly look inside the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Flipping the calendar from February to March, that's very nice. And it's a bright, sunny morning here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Warmer things ahead, Dave.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. Things around 40 today, as we were reporting, and some rain tomorrow. But
I'm grilling today.
Yeah, and you're grilling today.
I'm grilling today, yes.
Think of it this way, though. Temperatures above freezing, days getting longer.
Yes.
There's a bit of a chance of snow later in the week, but nothing, we're not talking, major accumulation.
Just something to remind us that it's March.
It's not quite spring yet.
Yeah, but we're getting there. I mean,
we are.
Spring training baseball going on.
Oh, yeah.
We got March Madness basketball ahead
mm-hmm.
of us. NCAA tournament just around the corner.
Yep.
All kinds of things to kind of take my mind off the Blackhawks.
Although, well, they had a win.
Yes, and you know, Joe, welcome to the show. I want to tell you, I was watching the game yesterday, and they flashed on the TV the cryon that said that after two periods, the LA Kings with a lead were 20 wins, one loss, one tie. And I'm sure happy to add another loss to them after that. I mean, that was like watching the old Blackhawks yesterday.
Yeah, those are the types of games they're able to pull out usually so well. And this year, it's just they've fallen flat.
Well, the third period is the killer.
Absolutely.
And after that Thursday night game, I mean, I had a crazy week. I had Thursday night was a Democratic gubernatorial debate. Friday night was a Democratic gubernatorial debate. But Thursday night, after the debate, finished in time with the story to be able to watch the second period of the Blackhawks game against San Jose. So they were only losing 2-1 after one.
Right.
And then it was 3-1. And then it was 4-1. And then it was 5-1. And then it was 6-1. And then it was 7-1. And then ended 7-2. I mean,
that was their first victory when trailing heading into the third period since December 8th. They did it against Buffalo. And, you know, it's like you said, it's been those momentum killers that's really been their bugaboo this year. They just can't stop it when things start to turn, you know, the tables turn, and that's been the worst part this year.
You know, and the Kings are a really good team.
They are. And like you said, easily one of the best to close out a game. So that's what made yesterday's win so much more significant.
Yeah, and so today, Anaheim, 3 o'clock. I kind of like these back to
Oh, I love 3 it.
O'clock
I love
games.
It.
That's a perfect way to spend the afternoon. And
what's Anaheim's record?
I don't know what the Ducks
top
are.
Of my head. They're one of the top ones.
One of the top ones. Have the Hawks done well against them past games this season?
You really put me on the spot right
Sorry.
Now. It's okay. Yeah, the Ducks are 32, 21, and 12.
So they're playoff.
Yeah. All the other consistent teams in the Western Conference have been up there. It's the Blackhawks that have been the one that, you know, really kind of surprised the league. But obviously injuries and the other things that they've dealt with is been their falter.
Well, I'm looking forward to the game today. The trouble is it's back-to-backer games, and that second game of back-to-back is normally a really tough one.
True.
I will tell you, it was that game yesterday just inspired me again. And, you know, I know they're not going anywhere, but I'm still rooting for them.
But it's good to see them able to pull out games like that. It's good to see, you know, some of the core players start performing as well. I mean, Jonathan Toews, Patrick Kane, both with big games. I mean, that's what you want to see to hopefully translate into next season.
Well, and I don't know if you noticed too, Joe, but Jonathan Quick, the Kings goalie, is always one of the top goalies in the league.
Right.
Very sloppy with rebound control.
Yeah.
And that that led to a couple of goals right out in front. And but that's the good thing about yesterday's game is there were Hawks actually out in front of the goal get it.
Greasy goals. That's what Q loves.
Well, yeah, and that's how you win.
Absolutely.
I mean, you got to crash the net. You got to do all those kinds of things. And that's been part of the frustration this year has been that.
Dave, the Hawks and Ducks are 1-1 against each other.
1-1? Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
But, yeah, so let's go Hawks.
Let's go.
Let's go Hawks. Pre-game at 2:30, and the puck drops at 3 o'clock. John and Troy with all the action right here on WGN 720. Let's go Hawks.
Let's go Hawks.
And let's go White Sox, too.
Yeah, how about it? Like you said, spring training's here. I mean, this is some of the best time of the year for sports right now.
Right. Well, and, you know, you touched on it, too, about Loyola playing Illinois State mm-hmm. for the MVC championship. Automatic berth to the NCAA tournament. Loyola having just a fantastic year. But what was really interesting, the Final Four in that MVC tournament were all Illinois colleges.
Yep.
And so a school from Illinois guaranteed to go to the NCAA.
That's great. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Finally. I mean, obviously Northwestern last year, and they took kind of the nation. You know, everyone had their eyes on them, but it's always great when you know you're at least going to get one.
Yes. And so, I mean, I'm sorry about my Salukis.
Hey, that's
losing.
Okay. I'm a Redbird.
Well, and good for the Redbirds.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, it's extremely hard to root against Loyola too. I mean, obviously I'm gunning for ISU, but if they lose, and I don't know, I don't want to say probably because you never know, but Loyola is a very good team.
Yeah. Well, and they are kind of like a Cinderella team this year.
Yes. Yes.
And if they and that's the thing I was telling people, you know, I'm not sure if they lose today. I don't know if they get a berth.
They probably do not.
Yeah.
The conference alone doesn't get much love.
No.
And I mean, the whole story this year has been Loyola needs to win the tournament. They've looked at their schedule, you know, only a couple of big wins this year, which is unfortunate because, I mean, the conference is very competitive. I mean, I'm a huge advocate for it. And ISU has been the team that's kind of missed out because of, you know, not getting a lot of value to their wins.
Quality.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So I mean, obviously it's a win-win because one team from the conference will make it, and I mean, we'll see today.
And I don't know what time that game is.
1 o'clock. Oh. 1 o'clock. CBS.
So perfect. So
oh, great.
There's that, and then right to the Blackhawks.
It's a great segue.
Oh, and it will be a perfect way to then have the pork chops on the grill today, and then crash before the Oscars because I have no clue. I have seen very few of these movies, and thank goodness Dean Richards will be in later to give everybody an update on what's going on with the Oscars. I do want to say though. Allison Janney has got a win for her role as Tanya Harding's mother in I, Tanya. That was just a magnificent performance. But
did you see Darkest Hour?
I did see Darkest Hour.
Yeah,
yes,
Gary Oldman is
Gary Oldman.
Churchill.
Yes, absolutely. That I mean another terrific performance.
Mm-hmm.
So, just what a day! What a Sunday! And that's why, of course, it'll rain tomorrow on Monday, right? So everybody, get all your excitement going today, because then we're back into Monday. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Joe's got the latest sports. Producer Cassara's here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. That's our text line as well, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is taking away my Blackhawks hat for the rest of the season. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes. Just search for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead, after we catch up on the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Dan Montgomery. He's the president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers, and we'll talk about a lawsuit called Janus versus AFSCME. That's a case before the U.S. Supreme Court that could have a dramatic effect on public employee unions. After the 8 o'clock news and sports, we'll speak to Democratic Congressman Dan Lipinski. He represents the Southwest Side and suburbs. He's facing a serious primary challenge from Marie Newman, and she's been on the show previously. We'll talk to him about his bid for re-election. After the 8:30 news and sports, we'll speak with Joe Berrios. He's the Cook County Assessor. He's facing a primary challenge as well, and we'll talk to him about all of these controversies about property taxes. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and we're still discussing the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida high school shooting, which killed 17 people last month. A lot of talk in Washington, but so far, very little action. Last Sunday, there was a remarkable interview between Jake Tapper on CNN and Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel about the lapses, apparent lapses in law enforcement in its prior contact with the shooter and their failure to intercept his guns long in advance of the tragedy.
Are you really not taking any responsibility for the multiple red flags that were brought to the attention of the Broward Sheriff's Office about this shooter before the incident, whether it was people near him, close to him, calling the police?
Jake, I could only take responsibility for what I knew about. I exercised my due diligence. I've given amazing leadership to this agency.
Amazing leadership?
I've worked... Yes, Jake. There's a lot of things we've done throughout this. You don't measure a person's leadership by a deputy not going into a. These deputies received the training they needed.
Maybe
they
measure somebody's leadership by whether or not they protect the community. In this case, you've listed 23 incidents before the shooting involving the shooter, and still, nothing was done to keep guns out of his hands, to make sure that the school was protected, to make sure you were keeping an eye on him. Your deputy at the school failed. I don't understand how you can sit there and claim amazing leadership.
So we now know that the school's police resource officer, Scott Peterson, opted not to enter the building, but stayed outside to form a perimeter. Along with at least two other sheriff's deputies. That's what they were directed to do, apparently. But now we've also found out that that's what dispatch has told them, to form a perimeter. But President Trump, well, he is his own perimeter.
I got to watch some deputy sheriffs performing this weekend. They weren't exactly Medal of Honor winners. All right. The way they performed was, frankly, disgusting. They were listening to what was going on. The one in particular, he was early. Then you had three others that probably a similar deal a little bit later, but a similar kind of a thing. You know, I really believe, you don't know until you test it, but I think I really believe I'd run in there even if I didn't have a weapon. And I think most of the people in this room would have done that too, because I know most of you. But the way they performed was really a disgrace.
Not sure about the president's running abilities there, but a lot of people on social media questioning the fact that his military deferments came from bone spurs in his feet. The president did say that he directed his Department of Justice to look at banning bump stocks through an executive order. Bump stocks, an item used to turn a semi-automatic firearm into a near-automatic weapon. Here again is the president.
By the way, bump stocks, we're writing that out. I'm writing that out myself. I don't care if Congress does it or not. I'm writing it out myself, okay? You put it into the machine gun category, which is what it is. It becomes essentially a machine gun, and nobody's going to be able. It's going to be very hard to get them. So we're writing out bump stocks.
Now, during one of these several listening sessions that the president's held, Trump's idea of arming teachers really appears to be going nowhere. In one gathering, Washington State's Democratic Governor Jay Inslee, he had a suggestion that he presented to the president.
Let me just suggest whatever percentage it is. I heard at one time you might have suggested 20%. Whatever percentage it is, speaking as a grandfather, right, speaking as a governor of the state of Washington, I have listened to the people who would be affected by that. I've listened to the biology teachers, and they don't want to do that at any percentage. I've listened to the first grade teachers that don't want to be pistol packing first grade teachers. I've listened to law enforcement who have said they don't want to have to train teachers as law enforcement agencies, which takes about 6 months. And I just think this is a circumstance where we need to listen, that educators should educate, and it should not be foisted upon this responsibility of packing heat in first grade classes. Now, I understand you have suggested this, and we suggest things, and sometimes then we listen to people about it. Maybe they don't look so good a little later. So I just suggest we need a little less tweeting here, a little more listening, and let's just take that off the table and move forward.
Now, a strange thing did happen in one of these sessions. Trump appeared to adopt more of a Democratic orthodoxy on guns than Republican, and the president went so far as to support gun seizures without true due process. He basically hijacked a conversation from his vice president, Mike Pence.
But the focus is to literally give families and give local law enforcement additional tools if an individual is reported to be a potential danger to themselves or others. Allow due process so that no one's rights are trampled, but the ability to go to court, obtain an order, and then collect not only the firearms, but any weapons in the possession
of
that
individual. Or might take the firearms first and then go to court, because that's another system. Because a lot of times, by the time you go to court, it takes so long to go to court to get the due process procedures. I like taking the guns early, like in this crazy man's case that just took place in Florida. He had a lot of firearms. They saw everything. To go to court would have taken a long time. So you could do exactly what you're saying, but take the guns first, go through due process second.
There's a bit of a dispute over that going on internally with the Justice Department. Illinois lawmakers in Springfield, meanwhile, they began moving legislation to license gun dealers, raise the age to 21 to purchase a semi-automatic firearm, create a 72-hour cooling-off period for buying an assault weapon, as well as a move to ban bump stocks. But in Washington, Illinois' senior Democratic Senator Dick Durbin is decrying the lack of action on the federal level. He commended the Parkland High School students for keeping the issue alive before the public.
The clear question we have in America today is whether we've reached a tipping point when it comes to gun violence. It's only been 13 days since the tragedy in Parkland, Florida. And look what's happened since. Of course, outrage, sadness, mourning for the families that lost these wonderful students, teachers, and administrators. But beyond that, these high school students, 17, 18 years old, some even younger, have really become a national voice, a powerful voice on the issue of gun safety in schools. I often wondered when this moment might occur or whether it would occur.
That is Illinois' senior Senator Dick Durbin. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Let's go. Welcome back, Chicago White Sox. Hey, baseball belongs right here, 720 WGN.
What do I cherish? Precious moments watching Dad read to my little Eric. That's why I'm so grateful I insisted on an eye exam when I noticed him struggling with the words on the page. We found out Dad has age-related macular degeneration, or AMD. Luckily, the doctor caught it in time for treatment, so Dad can still read. Protect yourself and your loved ones. Call the Foundation Fighting Blindness today at 1-800-254-6552 for a free packet on preventing and managing AMD. That's 1-800-254-6552.
I'm Dr. Sandy Goldberg, a breast cancer survivor. I founded a Silver Lining Foundation in 2002 to raise awareness of early detection and eliminate cost concerns. Do you live in the greater Chicagoland, Rockford, or Elgin areas? Are you uninsured or underinsured? Are you a survivor who needs follow-up testing? We're here to help, and it's free. If you called us last year, now's the time for your annual mammogram. Life is tough, but getting a mammogram isn't. Call us at 312-345-1322. There is a silver lining.
Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Dan Montgomery. He's the president and chief operating officer of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. We'll be talking to him about a federal court suit before the U.S. Supreme Court, Janus versus AFSCME, which could have serious ramifications on public employees' unions.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Just over my news feed, Roger Bannister, the first runner to break the four-minute mile, has died at the age of 88. He clocked 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds over four laps on May 6th, 1954, to break the four-minute mile. So a name of history right there, Roger Bannister passing away at the age of 88. Joining me now on the phone is Dan Montgomery. He is the president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. And Dan and many others are watching a very important court case in the U.S. Supreme Court, Janus versus AFSCME. Dan, thanks for joining me this morning.
It's good to talk to you, Rick. How are you?
I'm better after the Hawks win yesterday. I'll tell you that much.
Rough year.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, let's talk about this court case. Basically, before the court is a challenge to a requirement that public employees pay at the very least what's known as a fair share portion of dues to cover non-political activity like collective bargaining and appeals processes and administrative costs. And that fair share fee is the subject of the challenge. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah. So I want to make something really clear because you hear union opponents often saying, you know, people are, including Bruce Rauner, saying, you know, people shouldn't be forced to join the union. No one in this country is forced to join a union. But for 40 years plus, the Supreme Court has ruled it's totally legal for unions to charge a fee to the people they legally must represent for purely representational efforts, like you said, like bargaining a contract or administering a grievance, something like that. 20 states allow it. It's up to the states. It doesn't even force it to happen. But 23 states allow it. And those fair share fees are intended to solve a really challenging problem, which is if you don't do that, then you have free riders, as the court said, right? And you've got people who will take all the advantage of the union's work and enforce it, and in fact, you know, the union is required to do this work for them without paying anything. So, and the money they pay has nothing to do with politics. They don't, as you said, don't have to pay for any of the political end of things. So it's the law in Illinois. It's been the law in 23 states. We're talking about public sector workers here now that that this Janus case relates to. And it seems clear that this court, now really tilting to the far right, is prepared to kind of strip away those rights. And unions will have to represent people who pay nothing and are going to lose some voice in the process, no question.
Well, I know that in oral arguments that were held, Justice Kennedy came out very, very vehemently against these fair share payments. And Kennedy has always been kind of known as someone who would be a potential swing vote in a variety of cases before the Supreme Court.
Yeah. He was. I read the transcript. He was just like actively hostile. I mean, it was weird, and the way it was reported, they said he was sort of shouting, and I mean, it's very disappointing. And the other justices made clear, like, listen, this goes against a core conservative principle to let former precedent stand, and you know, the idea of stare decisis, right? Once the court has already decided something, that's the law, and they tend to say, like, we need to keep that law. It's good for the government. It's good for, you know, American polity and jurisprudence to know what the position of the court is. This was decided 40 years ago by a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. It was a unanimous decision, and it's been challenged in various ways since, this idea of fair share fees. And every time they've allowed it, they've upheld it, including Scalia multiple times. So this is a radical right-wing departure in American law if they decide to overturn these fees, which it seems like they will. You know, there a lot of people have written about this being funded by the Koch brothers, by the Illinois Liberty Justice Center, which is one of those, you know, state policy network groups. These groups together have got about, you know, I think $80 million devoted to this very effort. The Koch brothers have chipped in another $400 million. Bruce Rauner himself has contributed to the Illinois Liberty Justice Center that is kind of prosecuting this case. You probably saw Bruce Rauner actually went to the Supreme Court. This is a governor who has stayed silent on DACA, has stayed silent on guns post Parkland, has stayed silent. He wouldn't even call David Duke a Nazi, but he flew to Washington to sit in the Supreme Court and and then come out and do a news conference about how important it is to hurt unions. Very, very disappointing.
Well, and this was a case that basically he instigated. There was even the court struck it down, but the attempt by his administration to say that there wouldn't be any collection of union dues.
That's right. Yeah, you're right. That was like one of the first things he did in office in the first week or so. He went to federal court and sued something like 30 unions. He sued our workers, teachers at the Illinois School for the Deaf. I mean, these are incredibly dedicated, highly credentialed people, really doing a tough job in Jacksonville and Illinois, and a great job they do. In fact, their team just won at Gallaudet University, sponsors an academic bowl every year, and their team was one of the finalists. I actually didn't hear the outcome if they won or not, but they went to the finals. Yeah, great place. He sued them so they wouldn't have to pay fair share fees, and you know, the idea there again is we don't want them to have voice and a say at work. It's really mind-boggling, but you know, for all the things Rauner does, he seems most motivated by hurting unions and hurting working people.
Well, one of the things he's said about this is that, as far as public sector unions, that he considers everything they do to be political. And political in nature, including the collective bargaining process, is a political process, is what he says.
Yeah, I mean, the courts, including the Supreme Court, I mean, they decided that exact issue 40 years ago and said, no, I mean, you're bargaining. And let me tell you, I became a school teacher, high school teacher. I didn't do it to be in a union, but you know, we were all unionized. We sat together, and you'd bargain wages and benefits, but all sorts of things that have nothing to do with political speech. You know, where's the bulletin board going to be? We have parent-teacher conferences. How do we structure that? I mean, so many things. Class size. I mean, these aren't political. No reasonable person, I think, really thinks of those things as political speech. It's simply they don't want workers to have a voice. That's really what it amounts to. And now they've got enough, you know, really far right wing jurists on the court to think that they've got the ability to overturn this. And again, I really don't think that the Koch brothers and the Rauners are really interested in free speech. They're interested in putting hundreds of millions of dollars behind reducing the voice of people who oppose them on things like, you know, tax cuts for the rich.
Well, what with the expectations that the court will strike down that fair share requirement, what does that mean for the future of public employee unions?
Yeah, they're going to take hit. I mean, it's going to be hard. They're going to have to, again, we're going to have to represent people who don't pay anything for that representation. There will be free riders. I will tell you, I'm encouraged. I mean, we've seen this coming. We're working really hard in our union, local by local, to, you know, kind of get back to the roots and say, listen, we're going to have one-on-one conversations with all our members. They have to really re-understand why we're a union, why we're together. You're never going to get rid of labor unions. You're never going to get rid of people's desire to better their lives and for them to come together collectively to work. There's one of the points made at the Supreme Court was this is quite liable to add to labor unrest. And I think that's true. You know, I remember a few years ago in Illinois, they were trying to SB7 was the bill, and it's when Rahm Emanuel wanted to make it harder for the teachers union to strike in Chicago, and there was all this stuff. And we did research, and we showed, look, before the public bargaining law in Illinois, 1986 it went into effect, there were a lot more teacher strikes than there are now. There's, honestly, throughout Illinois, any given year now, there's a handful, 1, 2, 3, there were over 20 on average in the years leading up to the public bargaining law. So I think you're going to see more people sort of asserting their power collectively and having to find every way to do it. Look what's happening in West Virginia now.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a right-to-work state. They don't have collective bargaining quite the same way that we do, or a public labor act like we do. But that's not stopping them from saying we are not going to take their like 48th or 49th in the nation in teacher pay, and you know they're going to see huge cuts with what they want to do with health insurance there. You know, I mean, unions are just going to have to work harder, go back to their roots, and but it will hurt them. I think it will financially strap a lot of unions, and that's the intended goal.
We're speaking with Dan Montgomery, president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. I'm speaking with Dan Montgomery. He's the president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. We're talking about a upcoming U.S. Supreme Court decision on a case based out of Illinois, Janus versus AFSCME, about requiring public employees to pay a fair share fee for representation by unions. And we've got a question from Ron. Ron, thanks for joining the program.
Yes, good morning, Rich. Dan, common question. Generally, I support collective bargaining. But if there is a perception, and I'm not a right-wing person or anything like that, but there is a perception that, in actual fact, that most unions support Democrat candidates. Okay, and it's always quid pro quo. But and then what it happens is that a lot of times then these elected officials give out these benefits, and sometimes we can't afford it. So the taxpayers, so I try to contrast that like with the private sector unions, you know, they have to kind of work within their, you know, financial means. But see, in the public sector with government, it's like, okay, well, we can give you all these, as we see with some of these benefits, retirement benefits. But yeah, generally speaking, I am one, but with public sector unions, and I've been working 40 years, I've never been in either union. But that's kind of a concern about regular, as they say, working class people, that the unions are getting a lot more than what taxpayers can afford. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Ron.
Yeah, I think Ron kind of captured that question well. I'd say a couple things. One, you got to remember that that's sort of not what this case is actually about, because unions under fair share laws, none of the fees they collect have anything to do with politics or go towards political money. They can only charge for the costs of, you know, representation. So the constitutional issue isn't what Ron just said, but to Ron's point about supporting Democratic candidates, you know, in my union, we strive and struggle to find Republicans we can endorse, and we do sometimes. There are a lot fewer of them now, and as the Republican Party has turned farther and farther to the right, you know, but we have Republican members, you know, and we do find, and if we look at the issues, it's not based on party politics. It's like, what is their position on our issues, on educational issues, issues around labor, things like that. So, you know, my union, we endorsed Governor Jim Thompson a number of years ago. He was a pretty moderate Republican.
Well, you know? 4 years ago, you endorsed in the Republican primary for governor.
We did, Kirk Dillard in the Republican primary for governor. And I would posit he would have made a much better governor for this state than Mr. Rauner. So, you know, I understand his Ron's question, but I just think that, you know, one, that's not the constitutional issue at stake here, and that, you know, we'll support more Republican candidates when they support things like reasonable and sane gun laws to protect children in schools, when they support, you know, Bruce Rauner on school funding in Illinois. He's going around claiming he's the guy that's fixed school funding. He then put a hold on the new money that's supposed to already have gone this year, $350 million, to public schools, and they still haven't gotten it because of his gamesmanship. So, you know, we can't endorse those kind of people.
Well, I wanted to switch over to ask you about the governor's budget proposal, and most particularly a proposal to shift the costs of pensions onto teacher pensions onto local school districts. Now, I mean, it seems pretty much to be a non-starter.
It does. I agree with you. I mean, Republicans and Democrats alike don't like that idea because it will entail a massive local property tax increase. That's the problem. And I will tell you that I think if you were designing a retirement plan, a pension plan from scratch, you would have said, look, the members, the individuals got to pay, teachers do. We pay 9% out of every check toward our pension. And the local employers got to pay as well as the state. So right now the local employers pay hardly anything. So I understand that's like an equity issue. The problem is you can't just fix that by saying, okay, boom, here's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars you guys are going to have to pay now like that. And that's what people are objecting to. And again, the effect of it is going to be a local tax increase, which Rauner, let me see, I thought he was against that.
Well, and that's part of this conundrum here is this issue of everybody wanting to address increases in property taxes and talking of property tax freeze or limitations or those kinds of things, but yet there is, you know, this constant talk on the state level of trying to shift more of the burden onto local governments, local school districts, which, of course, that's where they get their funding is from property taxes.
Yeah, and so when you look at this, I mean, the smart people from the kind of the center and the mainstream of thinking, you know, look at Illinois' finances and say, look, so one of the things we have to do is fund schools with more dollars from the state of Illinois. Illinois was about 48th in the country in state dollars for education. They went a long way toward that last year because they redid this funding formula. But what they didn't do was add in the full amount they need to fully fund that formula, which is in the order of $4 or $5 billion with a B, dollars more every year from the state. And that would get them kind of into the range of normal, if you will. If they did that, that's a tremendous amount of property tax relief because, and it won't happen overnight, but local communities will not have to keep raising their property taxes every year, every few years to pay for their schools because the state will be doing its job. Now, for them to do that, and Republicans and Democrats voted for that bill, for them to do that, to fully fund school funding, they've got to have a different tax structure. We think the best way to do it is progressive tax, have wealthier people pay more of their fair share. That's why we endorse J.B. Pritzker, for instance. It's something that Democrats are saying that's what they want to do in Springfield. You know, it's got to happen in a way so that, you know, middle and lower income people don't end up paying more. And, you know, 39 states already have that, and we should join the sort of modern world and upgrade our tax system that way. If we do those things, you can fund your schools, and, you know, you can relieve the tax burden. And it is true. It is true in Illinois that the property tax burden has gotten too high, and that's simply because the state has not fully funded schools the way they need to.
We see all of the Democratic candidates for governor talking about going to a graduated income tax, but that's not something that can happen quickly, not something overnight. It would require a constitutional amendment. And frankly, it's been tried before, and part of the hang-up is because no one wants to put those rates in the Constitution, and there's kind of the people saying, you know, well, if I don't know how much the tax rate is going to be, I'm not so sure I want to be for this.
Yeah, I think a couple things. I think you're absolutely right about that, including our members. They get kind of spooked by that because you don't know what are people talking about, right? So I think, one, it can happen. I think times are changing. I think people are looking around and, you know, they look at the tax cut we had from the Republicans. They look at the world we're in. You look at the Kochs and people like that spending hundreds of millions of dollars against the economic interests of regular working people. And I think the times are right for it, quite honestly. You remember when Rauner was elected a few years ago, I think my numbers are more or less right. He got about 1.8 million votes in Illinois. There was a proposal, non-binding, but a proposal to have a millionaire surcharge tax on millionaires. That got 2.2 million votes, significantly more than the number of people that voted for Rauner were in favor of that. So I think the idea, and I've seen polling around the state that shows people are in favor of the progressive income tax. It's just kind of figuring out how to do it. I think that will happen.
That's Dan Montgomery. He's President and Chief Operating Officer of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. Dan, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Rick, it's always a pleasure. Go Hawks. Enjoy your afternoon. Let's hope they win today.
Let's go Hawks. Thanks, Dan.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. The Utah House of Representatives did their own kind of comedy take on how a bill becomes law. They decided to do a rap. A Utah rap. Here's a bit of it, and I think most people might suggest that the legislators stick to their day job.
Now, this is a story all about how
our bill gets flipped and turned off.
I'd like to take a minute and just sit right there.
I'll tell you how a bill becomes law and lives by change back.
In a legislator's mind, an idea is raised.
In the law book is where they spend most of their day.
Drafting out, maxing out, hardly relaxing, all cool.
And all introducing bills inside of House chambers.
We're more than a couple of guys start reviewing a few.
Are they making changes in committee on the Hill?
They may get warm in the fight, but it's just because they care.
They say we're moving this bill back to the floor, and we'll argue it there.
Speaker Hughes pushes for a vote, and the answer is clear.
And the bill passes and goes over the Senate to hear.
That's the Utah House of Representatives. Not quite your 101 civics lessons right there on how a bill becomes law in Utah. Well, joining me now on the phone is Congressman Dan Lipinski. He is the 7th-term Democratic representative for the 3rd Congressional District, state's 3rd district, which is the southwest side and southwest suburbs. Congressman, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, it's good to be with you, Rick, and I'll just say I'll stick with the Schoolhouse Rock version of how a bill becomes law.
Yeah, that was the one I was trying. I'm just a bill, right?
I'm just a bill. I used to play that all the time when I was teaching Intro to American Government. I would love to show that, and I actually have sitting here in front of me a Christmas ornament that someone once gave me that actually plays that whole song. So,
But Christmas, I wouldn't want to mess the two up with government. That's for sure.
No,
Congressman. Again, thank you for joining me. I wanted to start out. You've got a serious primary challenge. What is the Democratic Party today?
Well, right now there is a battle for what the Democratic Party is going to be going forward. The Democratic Party, unfortunately, we've lost over 1,000 seats since 2010, you know, across the country. 4 years ago, we were at our lowest point in the U.S. House since Herbert Hoover was president. We've come up slightly since then, but we're still in a big hole. And there are those who, you know, want to have a Tea Party of the left in the Democratic Party to match, unfortunately, what's happened to the Republicans. But we need to have a big tent party. We need to rally around those issues that can bring all Democrats together, and that's what I've always done. First and foremost, we have to be for working men and women, for being champions of the middle class and taking care of the bread and butter issues that people really, really care about, and restoring the American dream. That brings all Democrats together, and I think that's what we should focus on. And I think that's what Bernie Sanders focused on. Unfortunately, Hillary Clinton, as the Democratic nominee for president, lost out to Donald Trump because there were people who didn't see the Democrats standing for working men and women.
And you've gotten AFL-CIO support, other union support, but at the same time, when you look at somebody like Jan Schakowsky, who's in House Democratic leadership, Luis Gutierrez endorse your primary opponent, doesn't that just show how split up this party is?
Well, it's unfortunate that there are those who don't really see that what we really need to do is have a big tent party. I just think it's very detrimental for the party, and it's also detrimental for the country.
Well, has the district changed? I mean, you've been there for 7 terms. It's still a, you know, blue district, but has the ideology in the district gone more to the left?
No, it really hasn't. The there have been some changes. Well, first of all, redistricting happened in 2012. We ran in the new district, so things changed at that time. And my district lost a lot of Democrats in the redistricting, but it's still a very much a, you know, bread and butter issue district, pragmatic district. A lot of people who grew up, I still have, you know, about a third of my district in the city, but a lot of people in the suburban areas grew up in the city, and they see the purpose of government is to help people and to help them out, make their communities better, stronger, you know, good jobs, good schools, good transportation. That's why I said on transportation committee. And so those things have not changed.
Well, I mean, obviously one of the big issues, you're one of the few, if not the only, House Democrat that is opposed to abortion rights. And it seems like the, you know, the party right there is telling people, well, that's a non-starter.
Well, it's unfortunate if you actually look at the, I saw a couple years ago someone put together a really interesting graph of over the last 40 years, the number of pro-choice Democrats in the U.S. House, the number of pro-life Democrats. Pro-choice Democrats kept pretty constant as pro-life Democrats went down. And that, so that's, you know, how the Democratic Party has gone down. As many, we're down 60 something seats from where we were just 8 years ago. And I think that's a problem for the party. We need to be more accepting of people with different viewpoints, as long as there are those core things that we can agree upon.
But as far as the district's ideology, you believe that you're in tune with that as far as abortion rights?
Well, this district is not for abortion on demand for 9 months. And those who are attacking me right now, that's what they want. And clearly, the district doesn't want that. Even Democrats in this district, that is not their position. That's an extreme position. So I think that's out of step with, certainly out of step with the district.
We're speaking with Democratic Congressman Dan Lipinski of the state's 3rd Congressional District. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We're speaking with Democratic Congressman Dan Lipinski from the 3rd Congressional District on the southwest side and suburbs. Congressman, you've been getting criticized from the further left side of the party, too, for opposing the Affordable Care Act, opposing the DREAM Act, supporting the Religious Freedom Act. You know, here again, kind of reflecting your reflection of a more social conservative attitude.
Well, first of all, the Affordable Care Act, we saw premiums go up in Illinois 37% for this year. There are problems with the way that bill was written. Since it passed, immediately I said, okay, this is not a law. We need to fix it. I've opposed repeal of it, and I have fought to make changes to it and to fix it. I actually helped to introduce a bill, a bipartisan bill that would lower premiums by 30% in the Affordable Care Act. So I'm actually trying to make the Affordable Care Act work because, unfortunately, the way it was written, it really has not, made health care, it's made it more accessible for some people, but it just has not worked the way that we need it to work. I have, you know, support the DREAM Act and the DREAMers. We need to give them a pathway to citizenship. I've been working again in a bipartisan group to figure out a way of putting together that agreement, just like the agreement that Dick Durbin had put together with Lindsey Graham and bipartisan group in the Senate. I've been working in the House, and we came up with a similar plan, which hopefully we are going to get done. And I'm a problem solver, and I know we need to sit down and work out these issues, come up with real solutions, and solutions that work. I'm not just going to support a slogan or a plan that does not really have a real opportunity to get implemented and to work. So that's what I've always been about. Unfortunately, it seems like politics today, people aren't really that concerned about what the details are. They're just putting out a slogan and with no real plan. Unfortunately, that's not the way that you really help people.
Well, is that Is that what politics has become and what party leadership has become in many respects, is kind of throwing things out there, and that this is a litmus kind of issue that members are supposed to follow?
Unfortunately, that's what certainly what I've seen. It's the American people are sick and tired of just the bickering and that not coming to solutions. That's one of the reasons Donald Trump got elected, because people saw him at the time, although he hasn't certainly hasn't governed that way, but they saw him at the time as being willing to say, hey, we need to compromise. There are some issues that he talked about that were attractive to Democrats, and talked about doing a big infrastructure bill, which has not happened, but he talked about issues like trade, and it's sort of he appealed across the they saw him as possibly breaking the mold and crossing party lines. People like that. That's what American people want to see, but unfortunately the parties keep going, you know, Republicans further right, Democrats are going further left. And it's not good for the country, and the American people are frustrated by that.
You mentioned about working on trying to fashion a compromise on the DREAM Act. Do you really think that that's something that is even going to be considered, despite all of the talk about the Dreamers and about immigration reform, given the fact that, you know, we keep seeing that as such a big political football?
Well, I remain hopeful. There are those of us in the House, I know, that and certainly senators also, who see this as a serious issue that we want to solve. We want to give the Dreamers a pathway to citizenship, come up with some compromise, which includes some border security, not Donald Trump's wall, but some border security. But I'm afraid that party leaders in both parties see this as a good political issue that they don't want to solve, because each side, I think, in some way sees it as being helpful politically, and that's why we are stuck where we are right now. That's why there's gridlock in Washington, and yet there are still those in both parties who are trying to, you know, take the parties, keep pushing them further to the extreme, and I'm just proud that I have been in there in the House as a problem solver. I've delivered for my district. I've gotten things done. I've gotten bills passed into law. There's going to be a manufacturing strategy for the first time in American history since Alexander Hamilton. That's going to come out in May, thanks to a bill that I wrote that got signed into law. And I've been able to deliver other things for my district and for the middle class, because I've been willing to sit down and compromise and come to solutions.
Well, and I wanted to talk more about that, because your opponent, Ms. Newman, has said you've been there 7 terms and you haven't done anything. When you talk about delivering for the district, what have you delivered for the district?
Well, more than $375 million for local transportation projects, and just in LaGrange, where my opponent lives, there's a block and a half from her house. I brought $700,000 to fix up the metro station, restore the historic station, brought in money to build a garage there in downtown LaGrange. There are a lot of things that I've been able to bring back for the district. Been able to get metro service added, CTA service added, transportation bill, big one we passed a couple years ago. Illinois got 10% more for roads and for public transit, and I've been a very big advocate for public transit. But like I said, I've been able to pass bills in the law that I've authored on manufacturing, to empower victims of sexual assault in the military, some environmental bills that I've been able to pass to protect our environment, to improve safety along rail lines. You know, these are issues, that everyday issues that people care about. I've been able to pass legislation on all these, and that's why, you know, I've been supported not just by the AFL-CIO, as you said, and 30 other unions. Got 30 local mayors who are supporting me, because I've gotten things done. I've helped take care of our communities.
Well, and I kind of get the reflection of, you have the view that some of these things that your opponent talks about are kind of, I think you use the term that somehow it's going to magically happen. And you also were, I believe, at that the one forum that you attended when someone asked about marijuana legalization, you said you really want to talk about the bread and butter issues.
Well, it was not just on that. We had gone through more than a half an hour of the debate, and there was not one question on jobs, not one question on education or on the environment. So that was the issue. It wasn't that particular question. It was just a line of questions that didn't really have to do with what, you know, middle class families, you know, work, you know, care about it every day, that really impact their lives and their families' lives.
Congressman, if people want to find out more about your campaign, your website?
LipinskyForCongress.com.
Congressman Dan Lipinski, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Good to be with you, Rick.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. It's a gorgeous, sunny Sunday morning. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in the studio is Joe Berrios. He's the Democratic assessor of Cook County. He's also the Cook County Democratic chairman. Mr. Berrios, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I appreciate it.
I want to start out, and I kind of got into this in the conversation with Congressman Lipinski, who's facing a primary challenge, as are you. What's going on with the Democratic Party these days? It seems to be, establishment is almost a dirty word for some Democrats.
Well, it's not a dirty word for me. You know, I love being part of the Democratic Party. It's a party that's always taken care of minorities throughout the history of its existence. But the thing is, today, you know, with the gubernatorial race that we have going on, there's an actuality, you know, you've got three candidates running, and, you know, the party, a lot of the party loyalists have split three different ways. So that brings a lot of other things into effect, because some of these other candidates that are running to, you know, if they're not with Pritzker, they're with Kennedy. If they're not with Kennedy, they're with Biss. So we have that division right now out in the communities as to where are people going to be with the gubernatorial election.
And does that kind of go down ballot?
Yeah, it goes down ballot because, you know, a lot of the candidates, the Democratic Party endorsed J.B. Pritzker. So I'm with J.B. Pritzker as chairman of the party. But, you know, I also find that, you know, some of the people who have come out against me within the party are with Kennedy. So, you know, you're getting that faction saying, you know, we're with Kennedy. You should be with Kennedy. But you're with Pritzker. And, you know, the thing is, all three had the opportunity to get the endorsement of the Cook County Democratic Party. Pritzker worked it very hard, talking to committeemen and going around making sure that he had, you know, their endorsements. And when we met, he did have 50% plus one of the committeemen and the weighted vote, so he got the endorsement. And as chairman, you know, you have to support the people who are being endorsed by the party. So, you know, I have not gone anywhere from that. I am with JB, and I will continue to fight for JB.
Well, and you mentioned Chris Kennedy, and Kennedy, for example, has been very strong in his remarks about you, about the property tax system in Cook County, calling it corrupt. And obviously an offshoot of the lane he's traveling.
Yeah, it's the lane that he's gotten into. You know, I know that all three of them came to the Democratic Party for the endorsement. So when they didn't get it, all of a sudden it was Joe Berrios, the evil guy, who stopped them from getting the endorsement. It could have very easily, the way we run the Democratic Party is every committeeman has a voice. Every committeeman has a weighted vote. And, you know, all three of them presented themselves. All three of them wanted the endorsement of the Cook County Democratic Party, even though now they say because they didn't get it, they didn't want it. But in reality, they all showed up. But the thing is, I told all three of them, work the committeeman. You have to work the committeeman, as you would do in any caucus, as you would do at any convention. You work the delegates. And, you know, the other two didn't work so hard. JB did, and he ended up with the endorsement.
So, as you said, you're being labeled by some of these as the evil guy.
Yeah, the evil guy, because they didn't get the endorsement. But, you know, in reality, it's not my endorsement to give. It's the endorsement of the party, and that's all 80 committeemen that meet together to make the endorsement.
Property taxes are being discussed in all levels of all contests. It seems like we're at a tipping point on people just kind of saying enough's enough. And, you know, as assessor, your job is to assess the properties. You're part of a property tax system that everybody seems to be fed up with.
Yeah, but, you know, what people have to realize, the assessor's office does not set the property taxes. We set the assessments. All the taxing bodies set the rates, which is the multiplier that's used on an end assessment in order to calculate the tax bill. But we do assessments, not rates. And, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, they're trying to say that I do the rates. No, I don't do the rates. The taxing bodies do the rates because they supply that information to David Orr, and David Orr calculates the rates, and those are the rates to come on. But in reality, all we do is assessments. And when I became assessor, I inherited a 40-year-old problem. Tax bills weren't getting out on time. People weren't getting taken care of at the assessor's office. Back in 2014, Tony Preckwinkle, myself, after looking at what I inherited, went through and said, you know, we want to get the tax system evaluated, see where the pitfalls are within the system. So, you know, we hired Tyler Technologies to come in and help us and evaluate not only the assessor's office, but the Board of Review and everyone else involved in the tax system. In turn, what we ended up doing was getting out the tax bills on time for the first time in 37 years, which saved taxpayers $5 million a month. For every month the tax bills are late, that's $5 million. It costs the taxpayers. It doesn't cost the taxing bodies anything because of the fact all they do is put it on to the following year's tax rate.
They would tack it on.
They would tack it on. So, you know, I remember one year we were 4 months late. That assessor back then was 4 months late. Can you imagine $20 million plus being lost? And then having to be made up the following year. So we made that one of the challenges, and we were able to go out and we were able to do that. And they haven't been late since then. And we will continue to do that. We increased services at the assessor's office. We went on to the communities and explained to people what their rights were, what they were entitled to. We sped up the system. In the old days, you had to wait an hour and 10 minutes to get service at the assessor's office. We've cut that down to 10 minutes. We get people in and on it because, you know, I feel that I work for the taxpayers. And we know when the taxpayers come into the office, they deserve to be helped and helped quickly. The other thing we did, we put in the erroneous exemption unit. In 4 years, we billed over $10 million. 4 years. These are individuals who are cheating the system and taking money from the system that they weren't entitled to. They were taking 10, 15, 20 exemptions they weren't entitled to. There was one gentleman out there who, you know, we were still in the courts with, but he took $1 million over 5 years. Think about it. $1 million that he took from taxpayers and put it in his pocket because he got exemptions he wasn't entitled to. But we went out and made sure. For seniors, we've gone out. We went to Springfield this year alone again to increase the senior exemption for them. Come the second installment, seniors are going to get two benefits. We increased the homeowner's exemption for everyone in Cook County who lives on their property, and we increased the senior exemption. So seniors are going to see a double bubble on their second installment tax bill. Well, they'll see a lowering because the exemptions got increased, and so will homeowners because of what we did. But we haven't been sitting down. Now, you know, the Tribune, this building that we're in, you know, they've come out, you know, they've been attacking, but they did that the first time I ran, you know, when I had two different opponents. But you know what? Joe's still standing, and Joe's going to continue to fight. And, you know, we're going to take our programs to the people of Cook County, and I can assure you, with Tyler Technologies, the Civic Consulting Group, and the Assessor's Office, we are going to come out with a better program to help straighten out some of the messes that I inherited from 40 years ago. And, you know, we've made that commitment.
We're speaking with Joe Berrios. He is the Cook County Democratic Assessor. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and here in studio with me is Joseph Berrios, the Cook County Assessor. Mr. Berrios, I want to ask you about, you touched on it towards the end before the break there about improving the system. And I guess the question becomes, what's taken so long?
You have to understand, when I went into that office, it was a 40-year-old problem. You do not solve a 40-year-old problem in a very short period of time. We inherited many, many problems at the office, and now we've got Tyler Technologies, we've got a Civic Consulting Group, and you got the assessor's office. The three of us are working together to make the system better for everyone. The plan is to get a better model in place where we take in more information, that we go out into some of these communities before we do the assessments and get the data from some of the local real estate people and see what in the actuality is actually happening in some of these minority communities. Because, you know, what you end up having is you see the regentrification in some of these areas, and because of those high prices, but you know, that doesn't mean the lower price houses are increasing in value that much. But you know, when you do a model, you have to take in different units as to what is actually going on. So between Tyler Technologies, who is a international known company, it's not just a local company who has done this forever and ever and ever. They're world renowned. And with the Civic Consulting Alliance, which, you know, when they came in there, I took a chance. We gave them full control. We gave them, you know, they had access to everything. And the thing was, I wanted to hear from them, you know, what they thought we needed to do to change. And we are going to change. And I've already gone on record saying that I'm committed to change and that we're going to make this system better.
But you had previously had a study that showed recommendations for changing the system.
But we took a look at that system. We took a look at it. We tried it. We ran it in parallel with our current system and with some of the modifications we made that Tyler had suggested. And we found that it didn't work. You know, then in some of the minority communities would have been assessed even higher had we used them because of the fact that the numbers were being skewed. But, you know, in reality, we took a look at it. We felt that it didn't work. And by the way, there has not been any other jurisdiction that has moved to even look at the system. So, I mean, if Cook County didn't want to use the system, doesn't mean they couldn't go out and try to sell it somewhere else. But in reality, no one else has even jumped on board trying to buy the system. So, you know what? The discrepancies we found, you know, we've got Tyler, who is a world-renowned, again, company, and we will work with them to make the system better. And they're confident that it will happen.
One thing that's been a theme in some of the campaign, even governor's campaign, is about big assessment reductions for downtown development that lead to increased burden onto lower and middle class property taxpayers.
Yeah, but there again, you know what? There are laws here in the state of Illinois that are, you know, that have been tested through the Supreme Court and everything else. They, you know, they have come down and said that when it comes to apartment build, you know, the big buildings downtown, that you should use the income approach and the appraisal approach, which is the best model looking at these buildings as to what their actual value is. I mean, you take
the revenue they generate.
Right, the revenue that it's generated with, you know, I mean, take a look at the new post office. You know, look at what kind of breaks they're getting over there, you know, trying to getting an old eyesore back on the track so we can actually get revenue down the road because they've improved the building, they cleaned it up the building. I mean, the city council, in fact, one of my opponents, Danny Solis, sponsored the TIF for it. You know, they're going to get multi-million dollars in breaks because of the city of Chicago investing in the in that building to make it a building that we can use for the future. So, you know, there are breaks that are given to certain people in certain buildings to get them back online so they can generate revenue. That's the same thing that we're going to have to do in the south suburbs, you know, where they have no industry and no commercial. We're going to have to make a significant investment in some of those communities to get some of these companies to come back in. Do we give them tax breaks? Do we give them, you know, incentives? You know, the county is already on board trying to bring them back into those communities because that, in actuality, they will have more people paying in that base, then that will lower the property taxes on the individuals who live in those areas. But that's a commitment we all have to make together, that we're going to reach out and bring them back into the community, because they're not going to come in there when they don't know what their future is going to be. Because if all of a sudden you hit them with a huge tax bill, they're not going to come here. You know, look what happened to Detroit. Look what happened to some of these other communities. You have to be able to look at what the actual value is, and that's what the law says as of January 1 of whatever year it is. So we have to look at that.
One other thing is the fact of your campaign relying on property assessment appeals lawyers for its funding.
Well, again, you know, I come from a very poor community. I'm not a rich guy like my opponent is, who has already given himself over $1.2 million, and he said he's going to give himself another million. I can't afford to do that. I'm a Cook County assessor. I'm not a rich investment broker who has gotten his money by lending money to companies that invest in the NRA, who invest in prisons, who invest in colleges that have been found to do to have cases where they've hurt minorities.
But is there a conflict of interest?
There's no conflict. We have over 2,000 attorneys that practice at the assessor's office. And if you look at the list of the people who contribute, it's only about 12%. If there was any quid pro quo, I'm going to tell you something, and you know it and I know it. If the other 88% would be looking at it and saying, no, you know, there's corruption there, you know, these people are giving him money, and, you know, he in turn is, you know, one hand washes the other. No. We look at the evidence that people bring us, and we make sure that the whatever assessment we put on a property is founded on, based on evidence and on the information that we have been able to obtain and what they have given us.
That's Cook County Assessor Joe Berrios, Democratic County Chairman of Cook County. Mr. Berrios, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.